Arabs, led by a certain Dewastich, the ruler of Panjikent, whom we know of thanks to the chance survival of a portion of his correspondence. There he refers to himself as, and is addressed as, Lord of Samarkand, King of Sogdia, challenging the current holder of that title, Gurak, who had been nervous of overtly going against the Arabs. We see Dewastich writing to a number of authorities, especially the Turks and the lords of Fergana and Shash, beseeching them to support his struggle. Unfortunately for Dewastich, the new governor of Khorasan was the implacable Sa'id al-Harashi, 722-724. Having received intelligence of the vulnerability of Arab rule in the region, Sa'id crossed the river Oxus as soon as he received his posting in late June 722. The Sogdian nobles were divided as to what to do. One group wanted to make a stand and sided with Dewastich, whereas the majority opted to seek asylum with the king of Fergana. However, the queen mother of Fergana was not well disposed to these refugees and informed Sa'id that the Sogdians had already left their land and established themselves at Khojand, which lies 150 miles northeast of Samarkand as the crow flies and is the gateway to the fertile valley of Fergana. Sa'id advanced upon it at full speed, and after a brief siege, the city's inhabitants surrendered. A postmaster sent Dewastich a short message about the conclusion of the affair. Here is the news. Khojand is finished, and all the people have left on the guarantee of the emir. Whatever nobles, merchants, and farmers there were, some 14,000, they have evacuated. If this is a reference just to the Sogdians and not the locals, then they had evidently undertaken a major exodus to escape from the avenging Arab force. Their fears were justified, for though Sa'id had promised them safe passage, he subsequently executed them, the nobles among them at least. A month later, in the late summer of 722, an Arab contingent dispatched by Sa'id caught up with Dewastich in his mountain stronghold to the east of Panjikent and brought to an end the revolt of this would-be king of Sogdia. This was the last Arab success in the region for a while, as Suluk stepped up his offensive. In 724, his forces surrounded an Arab army invading Fergana and annihilated all bar a few in a battle known to Muslim sources as the Day of Thirst. This prompted a major uprising against the Arabs right across Transoxania, and by 730 only Samarkand and a couple of fortresses were left in Arab hands. In 731, Suluk besieged Samarkand itself. The commander of the Arab garrison in the city sent an impassioned plea for help to the governor of Khorasan, Junaid al-Murri, who was at that time in Balkh. He marched to Kish and then paused to consider whether to take the long way round to Samarkand via the plains to the west or to follow the more direct route, which involved crossing a steep ridge of mountains through the Tashta Karacha Pass. He opted for the latter, but as luck would have it, he encountered a Turgesh unit in the vicinity of the pass. Junaid's men held out, but it was clear that they would not escape alive without reinforcements. The only option was to turn for help to those they were meant to be helping, that is, to call upon the commander of the Arab garrison in Samarkand to come to their aid. Reluctantly, its commander set out with 12,000 soldiers and managed to relieve Junaid, though in the process lost all but 1,000 of his men. Junaid and the remnants of his army made it into Samarkand, where they were able to hold out long enough for the Turks to get tired and leave. This Battle of the Defile, as it came to be known, marks a low point in the rule of the Arabs in Transoxania. Had they not managed to hold Samarkand, they might have lost control of the entire region to the Turgesh. Thwarted in their expansion plans to the west, the Turgesh turned to the east, but this proved no more fruitful for them. and in 736, Suluk was soundly defeated by the Chinese in the Tarim Basin. He resolved to try one last time to dislodge the Arabs, and in 737 he crossed the Oxus accompanied by allies from Sogdia and Tukharistan. Their target was the city of Balkh, which the current governor of Khorasan, Asad ibn Abdallah, was using as his headquarters. Suluk divided up his troops and dispatched them to raid in different directions. It turned out to be a bad decision, for Asad came out with a very large force and encountered the Khagan with only a relatively small retinue. Suluk was obliged to flee, and with this second defeat, his reputation was fatally damaged. The next year, a rival Turgesh faction hunted him down and slew him. With this threat removed, the new Arab governor of Khorasan, Nasr ibn Sayyar, 738 to 748, was well placed to reassert Arab control of the region. Previous appointees had generally come from the west, with little or no knowledge of this complex land, but Nasr had spent most of his adult life there, in the staff of previous governors and as governor of Balkh. He had some appreciation of the local culture and politics, and was sensitive to the fact that there had been more than 3 decades of continual campaigning, which had caused huge loss of life on both sides. He therefore adopted a conciliatory stance upon taking up office. He wrote to the Sogdian nobles, inviting them to return home and promising to fulfill their previous requests, namely, those who had been Muslims and then apostatized should not be punished. No excessive demands for repayment of debts should be imposed on any of the people. They should not be required to pay any tax arrears which they owed to the treasury, and they should not have to return Muslim prisoners except at the decree of a judge backed up by the testimony of trustworthy witnesses. Many regarded Nasr as weak for caving in to such demands, but his policy of accommodation certainly lowered the tensions in this volatile frontier region and extended Umayyad rule there by a decade or so. In the end, though, this policy of moderation came too late to save the Umayyads, who faced a number of challenges from the east. Most significant was the insurgency masterminded by the shadowy figure of Abu Muslim, a native of East Iran, Transoxania, who recruited a large army from his homeland, comprising both Arabs and non-Arabs, and dispatched it westward to overthrow the Umayyads. Less reported is the Chinese attempt to reassert their authority in these lands in the wake of the enfeeblement of the Turgesh in 738 and of the collapse of the Eastern Turk Confederation in 744. This initiative was spearheaded by the celebrated Tang general Gao Xianji, also written Cao Xianqi, of Korean origin, who scored a number of victories in the Pamir Himalaya mountain region, particularly against the Tibetan Empire, from which he wrested control of the Buddhist kingdom of Gilgit in modern North Pakistan in 747. And when a couple of years later the kings of Fergana and Shash clashed and sought the backing of their imperial overlords, the Chinese and the Muslims respectively, Gao acted decisively, subjugating the capital of Shash after a short siege and taking many prisoners, including the king himself. Confrontation between the two empires seemed now inevitable. The Muslim garrison at Samarkand was alerted by refugees from Shash, and its commander, one Ziyad ibn Saleh, marched eastward once he had received reinforcements from Tukharistan, determined to teach the Chinese a lesson. Some 300 miles northeast of Samarkand, at Talas on the modern Kazakh-Kyrgyz border, he encountered Gao Xianji, who was supported by men of Fergana and Karluk Turks. The fighting took place over 5 days in July 751 without any breakthrough for either party, but then the Karluk contingent switched sides and the Tang troops were quickly routed. Like the Battle of Poitiers-Tours, The Battle of Talas has acquired legendary status, in this case, in the Arabs' favor. The great sinologist Carrington Goodrich ranked it as one of the decisive battles of history, and the renowned Russian orientalist Vasily Bartold regarded the Tang defeat as the decisive factor in determining which of the two civilizations, the Chinese or the Muslim, should predominate in Central Asia. In reality, as with the Battle of Poitiers-Tours, too much credit has been assigned to a single event. It may have slowed the Chinese advance, but it certainly did not stop it. Indeed, only 2 years later, the Chinese successfully dislodged the Tibetans from the Pamir region. The halt to Tang ambitions to the west was actually brought about by the rebellion of An Lushan, commander of all the armies of northeast China, which took 7 years to quash, 755 to 763, and caused irreparable damage to the Tang Empire. Provincial governors seceded, distant territories were lost, and the Tibetans and Uyghur Turks grabbed most of the western half of modern China and divided it up among themselves. The history of An Lushan, composed some 50 years after the uprising, emphasizes the Hu, East Iranian Transoxanian background of its subject. His father was Hu, he wore Hu dress, and his close followers were Hu. It also accords him a cult-like status. He was seated on a double bed while incense was burned before him and precious objects were arranged. The crowd of Hu around him prostrated themselves at his feet to implore the blessings of heaven, and he had the animals prepared and arrayed for sacrifice, while the sorceresses beat the drums, danced, and sang. There are many similarities between An Lushan and Abu Muslim. Both hailed from the wealthy, cosmopolitan, mercantile region of East Iran, Transoxania. Both proved to be masters of strategy in the planning of their respective insurgencies, and both inspired such fierce devotion in their supporters that they became the object of cults after their death. But whereas An Lushan failed in his aim of promoting Hu ascendancy in the Chinese Empire, Abu Muslim succeeded in winning a bigger role for the inhabitants of East Iran, Transoxania, in the future direction of the Islamic Empire. Caucasia and the Khazars. Another group that caused the Arabs a headache at this time was the Khazars, who had slowly been forging their own identity and establishing their own polity in the wake of the withdrawal of the West Turk Confederation from Caucasia in 630. They co-opted many local peoples under their lead, such as the Alans and Sabers, and from their capital on the River Volga, they controlled a large swath of the Ponto-Caspian steppe in what is now southwest Russia. Taking advantage of the Second Arab Civil War, they launched raids across Caucasia in 685, which brought them into conflict with the Arabs, and in the first half of the 8th century, there were numerous confrontations of increasing severity between these two youthful and ambitious powers. Abd al-Malik's son Maslama, who took over the governorship of Armenia and Azerbaijan from his uncle in 710, led a number of campaigns into Khazar territory, just beyond Darband, without achieving anything notable, but keeping his opponents on the defensive. In 718, though, encouraged by the failed Arab siege of Constantinople, the Khazars began to take the offensive and to raid Arab lands. They continued this over the next few years, and in 722, during a particularly bitter winter, they confronted and wiped out much of an ill-prepared Arab regiment, inaugurating a period of Khazar ascendancy. In 726, the Khazar Khagan sent his son Martik, who marched southward as far as Azerbaijan and besieged the settlement of Warthan, to the northeast of modern Tabriz, and defeated and killed the Arab governor of Armenia, who had come to lift the siege. 2 years later, Maslama targeted the Khagan himself, but after a few days of skirmishing, he almost fell into the hands of the enemy and only escaped by abandoning all the supplies of his camp, the servants, concubines, and maids. Muslim sources merely note that he returned safely, but the lack of any of the usual triumphant claims, God defeated the infidels through him, and so on, lends credence to the Christian reports of Maslama's ignominious flight. Martik returned to the fray once again in 730 and besieged Ardabil, the capital of Azerbaijan. Jarrah ibn Abdullah, who had been reappointed governor of Armenia, tried to relieve the city, but failed in the face of superior numbers of enemy troops. He sent an urgent message to the Caliph Hisham requesting reinforcements, but even as Maslama marched to his aid with as many troops as he had been able to hurriedly muster, Jarrah and his men were put to the sword. The Khazar cavalry roamed unopposed right across the region, plundering as far south and west as Mosul. The residents of Ardabil, seeing no signs of help forthcoming, submitted, with the result that the Arab garrison was massacred, the women and children were taken captive, and the Khazars took control of Azerbaijan. A hastily assembled force led by Said al-Harashi, the former governor of Khorasan, was able to rescue the captives and drive the Khazars back, even seizing from them the bronze image that they bore on a standard. It was, nevertheless, evident that the Khazars had struck a major blow against the Arabs. Despite harsh weather conditions, Maslama was dispatched in the spring of 731 with instructions to reassert Arab authority. Yet though he was able to inflict heavy losses, he shed their blood like water on the face of the earth and sated the birds of the sky and the beasts of the steppe with their flesh. The Khazars blocked his progress beyond the Caspian Gates at Darband, Arabic, Bab al-Abwab, and he could do no more than lay the groundwork for a more substantial future expedition. He recruited a large body of craftsmen and laborers and initiated the rebuilding and fortification of Darband, which was to serve as the major Arab garrison in the eastern sector of Caucasia, and he sent out a number of units to demand the submission of various strongholds in the vicinity. Command of Armenia, Azerbaijan, and northern Mesopotamia then passed in 732 to the competent Marwan ibn Muhammad, nephew of Abd al-Malik, who began by making peace with the Khazar ruler so as to buy time for rallying an army. In the course of 737, supported by Armenian troops, Marwan traversed the Alan Gates, the Dariel Pass, on the modern Georgian-Russian border north of Tbilisi, and passed through the land of the Alans until he entered the territory of the Khazars. Here, he surprised the Khagan, who was obliged to flee for his life. The following year, Marwan visited one by one the local lords in the mountainous region between the Caspian Gates and the Alan Gates, receiving or enforcing their submission. Effectively, he was doing what Khusro I had done 2 centuries beforehand, establishing a buffer zone between his realm and the steppe peoples to the north. Though still wary of each other, the Arabs and Khazars had come to realize that neither of them could defeat the other, and they moved from conflict to coexistence, consolidating what they already held and demarcating the limits of their territory. This northern limit to Arab Caucasia followed pretty much the same line as had existed between Byzantium and Persia, and as exists today between the Caucasian republics and Russia. This is principally a facet of the region's topography, since the high northern Caucasian mountain range forms a natural barrier to north-south movement, bar the Caspian Gates in the east and the Alan Gates in the center. The same 3 principalities as had existed in Byzantine-Persian times, Armenia, Georgia, and Albania, survived alongside the Arab realm, and they managed to maintain a high degree of autonomy. This was easiest for Georgia, which was more remote, and Armenia, which could more easily play the Byzantines and Arabs off against each other. Albania, Arabic Arran, with its capital at Parta, modern Barda, suffered greater loss of its independence, for it was easier to enter and traverse due to the wide coastal plain around Baku and the river Kura that ran through it. Moreover, it was the most accessible route for invaders from the north, and so the Arabs maintained a number of garrisons in the region, in particular at Darband, to which they transferred 24,000 Syrian Arabs, again following a policy of the Sasanian Persians before them. The Khazars themselves went from strength to strength, growing rich by acting as middlemen in the overland trade between Scandinavia and the Muslim world. Though tending to side with the Byzantines, they forged their own path, converting to Judaism and creating a distinctive and pluralistic culture. Sindh. The one piece of good news for the Arabs at this time was the conquest of the Indus River Valley, known as Sindh. The Caliph Uthman had already shown an interest in this region and had ordered his governor of Basra to send someone to find out whether it was worth conquering or not. The scout reached the arid wastelands of Makran that lead on to Sindh and sent back the message. The water supply is scanty, the dates are inferior, and the robbers are bold. A small army would be lost there, and a large army would starve. As a consequence of this intelligence, Uthman did not dispatch any army to this region. Some hardy Arab generals ventured in that direction anyway, but they encountered stiff resistance from the tribes of Kikan in modern western Pakistan, and two of them lost their lives in the 660s. Others tried to march along the coast, but the going is tough, as Alexander the Great had found almost a millennium before, for rainfall is minimal, and the craggy Makran Mountains come very close to the sea. Moreover, it was a sparsely populated region, though the rugged valleys and isolated ports harbored a number of Buddhist communities, according to the 7th-century monk Xuanzang. In the 670s, a small Arab garrison was established there, but it was a very unpopular posting, a land where most people are hungry and the rest are depraved. When Hajjaj ibn Yusuf was appointed Viceroy of the East in 694, he resolved to take control of this wayward frontier. What allegedly goaded him on to this decision was a rather strange event that has caught the imagination of scholars into modern times. The Lord of the Island of Rubies dispatched to Hajjaj, in the hope of winning his favor, some Muslim girls whose fathers were itinerant traders and had recently died. The reference is obscure, but in any case, the Med people of Debel, a town in the Indus Delta, east of modern Karachi, rowed out in canoes and captured the ship and its female cargo. A desperate plea for aid by one of the Muslim women eventually reached the notice of Hajjaj, who sent two generals, one after the other, to answer this entreaty, but both perished without accomplishing their task. A personal request by letter from Hajjaj himself to the local ruler, Dahir, met with the non-committal answer that they were captured by pirates whom I do not control. This hard-hearted response and the plight of the Muslim maidens are usually made into the casus belli for the Arab invasion of Sindh, though a number of years would appear to have separated the two events. Hajjaj eventually settled on a kinsman of his as the right man to carry out the difficult job of extending his authority over Makran and Sindh, namely, Muhammad ibn Qasim. He made sure his relative was fully equipped, even to the extent of packing for him cotton soaked in vinegar, because he had heard that vinegar was scarce there, and then finally dispatched him in 710 with the inducement that you are governor over whatever lands you conquer. Muhammad marched via Makran, first subduing Fanazbur in modern southwest Pakistan, and then kept going eastward until he reached Debel. Using catapults, he was able to breach the walls of the fort and damage the tower of the Buddhist temple, whereupon the local governor fled, and the temple guardians and many residents were slaughtered. He then pressed on up the Indus Valley, seeking out the local sovereign, the aforementioned Dahir. When he caught up with him, a fierce battle ensued. Dahir was killed, and so Muhammad ibn Qasim gained complete control of the country of Sindh. He sent a large proportion of the booty back to Hajjaj, who estimated its worth at 120 million dirhams, which pleased him greatly, since he had only expended 60 million dirhams on equipping and transporting Muhammad's troops. This is the outline of events presented by early Muslim sources, which gives us a fairly colorless picture of the Arabs marching around the country demanding submission, awarding guarantees of life and property to those who agreed, and conquering by force those who refused, confiscating huge amounts of gold in the process. The only concrete detail concerns the founding of Mansura in the 730s, the capital of Muslim Sindh, the ruins of which occupy some 4 square miles and lie about 40 miles northeast of modern Hyderabad. Later sources, especially the famous 13th century epic known as the Chashnama, present dramatically more information, including an account of the events preceding the Arab conquest. It narrates at length how the ruling Buddhist Rayis dynasty was ousted in a coup by its Hindu minister, who then married the last Rayis queen. The two of them begot Dahir, who lost the kingdom to the Arabs. Although this information has generally made it into the standard history books, none of it can be substantiated by contemporary sources. However, the monotonous statements of Arab victory in Muslim accounts can be set next to 2 declarations of success in battle against the Arabs by neighboring rulers in Gujarat. Presumably, some Arab contingents had marched south from Sindh in search of more conquest and booty, or perhaps sailed in by boat, looking to seize a share of the busy Indian Ocean trade. 2 of their encounters with the local population are described in texts written in Sanskrit on copper plates. These survived well in the wet climate of India, and so were commonly used to record important transactions, especially land grants. But in addition to this official business, donors would often take the opportunity to proclaim their heroic exploits and virtuous deeds. The earlier of the 2 texts, dated to 736, is from the Gurjara king Jayalbhata IV. Having completed the formal part of the text, that is, the details of the land grant, he proceeds to boast about his victory against the Arabs. "This is the same Jayalbhata," he affirms, "who with the edge of his sword has forcibly vanquished in the city of the Lord of Vallabhi the Arabs, Tajikas, who greatly opposed all people, and he did this as a cloud extinguishes with its showers the fire that troubles all people." Vallabhi was a celebrated center of Buddhist learning, possessing 100 monasteries and 6,000 priests, according to Xuanzang, and it was also a bustling port on the west side of the Gulf of Cambay, which may have been what attracted the interest of the Arab raiding party. Only a short time later, Jayalbhata himself needed to seek help against the Arabs, turning to the more powerful Chalukya kingdom to the south. He gained the ear of a local Chalukya lord, who came to his aid with a contingent of troops. Like Jayalbhata a short time before, this lord makes use of a land grant document to advertise his successes. He vaunts the honors that he has received from the Chalukya sovereign, and recounts the battle in which he defeated an Arab army. Since we have almost no such narratives from opponents of the Arabs in this part of the world, it is worth quoting in full. "The Arabs had destroyed many renowned kings with their piercing, brightly gleaming swords. Hurling arrows, lances, and clubs, the Arabs were eager to enter the south and conquer. From the outset, they came to subjugate the realm of Navasari. The tough, noisy hooves of their steeds kicked up the ground to shroud the earth with dust in all directions. Their bodies were hideous, their armor reddened with torrents of blood from innards that had burst out from the heavy bellies of great warriors who had rushed at them wildly and were mangled by the blades of their spears. The best among hosts of kings had not defeated them before. Any number of champions' bodies were armored with hair that bristled in the fury of their battle spirit. These were men who attacked the Arabs full on, giving their own heads in exchange for the extraordinary gifts and honors they had received from their lord. They bit their pursed lips cruelly with the tips of their teeth, their turbans and honed swords reddened by a thick veil of blood that had poured from wounds in the trunks and sloping cheeks of enemy elephants, which had only the nooks and crannies of countless battlefields for a stable. Though the Arabs were mighty warriors, who sliced enemy necks like lotus stalks and launched a hail of arrows tipped with forged crescent blades in a swift barrage to destroy their foes, they did not attain success. Though their bodies were covered with a coat of bristling hair on account of their martial spirit and excitement, they were defeated on the battlefront when headless bodies began a circular dance to the accompaniment of the loud noise of drums beaten continuously in joy, caused, as it were, by the thought, "Today at least we have, by laying down our heads, paid off the debt we owed to our Lord in this one life." Navasari and Vallabhi lie either side of the Gulf of Cambay, through which many ships passed on their way to the ancient port of Barigaza. And so it is very likely that the Arabs were trying to extend their control over international trade routes in the Indian Ocean. The two texts cited suggest that they were thwarted in this endeavor. Another copper plate, dated 753 and stamped with an image of the god Shiva, records that a Rashtrakuta king defeated the Chalukyas in 753 and appropriated their territories. This empire of the Rashtrakutas, religiously tolerant and culturally vibrant, dominated a large portion of the Indian subcontinent and lasted until the 10th century, limiting any further Arab military expansion southward from Sindh. It did not stop peaceful commerce, however, and we find a few references in Indian sources to such activity by Arab traders, or at least by those who are described as such, Tajikas, though whether this meant ethnic Arabs or Muslims, whether Arab or non-Arab, or inhabitants of the Abbasid Empire of whatever religious persuasion, is impossible to tell. From 9th century Kolam in southwest India, we have a set of copper plates that record in Tamil a land grant in favor of two trading communities. The text sets out the conditions under which they can trade, and is signed and witnessed by 14 persons writing in Persian, in both Pahlavi and Hebrew script, comprising Zoroastrians, Jews, and Christians, and 11 persons writing in Arabic, both Muslims and Christians. Evidently, then, trade was a very international business, and here, Arab Muslims rubbed shoulders with all manner of other races and creeds. A Society of Muslims and Non-Muslims. Before Abd al-Malik, we have no evidence for the public display of Islam by the state. Possibly, caliphs before him thought that Islam was only meant for the conquerors, not for the conquered, or that, as with Muhammad's community, people could keep to their own religion and there was no one official creed, or else they did not want to antagonize their non-Muslim subjects while their rule was still new and fragile. We do not really know. But in any case, this situation changed dramatically from the time of Abd al-Malik, when coins and documents, and even practical objects like milestones and glass weights, became emblazoned with Quranic slogans emphasizing God's oneness and Muhammad's mission. Individual believers, too, especially those going on pilgrimage to Mecca, inscribed on rocks and stones their belief in God and his prophets and their desire to join them in paradise and stay out of hellfire. Entrances to monumental buildings, mosques, and palaces began to display Arabic texts paying homage to God's power and Muhammad's prophetic status. This change was a response to the need to unify the conquest community after its acrimonious civil war, 683 to 692. It stressed the common faith that the majority of them held, and it focused their attention on their chief surviving enemy, the Byzantine Christian Empire. Many of the official religious slogans were accordingly chosen for their challenge to Christianity. In particular, Quran Surah 112, God the One, God the Eternal, He did not beget and was not begotten. And Quran Surah 9, Ayah 33, Muhammad is the messenger of God, whom he sent with guidance and the religion of truth that he might make it the dominant religion. And the magnificent Dome of the Rock, erected on the spot in Jerusalem where Jesus had predicted that not one stone will be left upon another, Mark chapter 13, verse 2, was decked out with beautiful tiles inscribed with a paraphrase of Quran, Surah 4, Ayah 171. The Messiah Jesus, son of Mary, was only a messenger of God, and his word which he committed to Mary, and a spirit from him. Do not say three. God is only one God. He is too exalted to have a son. This process of elevating Islam to the religion of state was inevitably accompanied by a demotion of all other religions, and in the decades after Abd al-Malik, Muslim lawyers gradually worked out a legal framework for incorporating all creeds into Islamic society, whereby the non-Muslim faiths would have a subordinate but protected status within the new empire. The result was a society that was increasingly ordered along religious lines. Differential status. Of course, all states make some distinction between categories of people living within their borders and accord them different rights. Some differentiate between full citizens and resident aliens, the latter facing a number of restrictions. In the Greco-Roman world, such people, called metoikos in Greek, peregrinus in Latin, were not allowed to hold public office, own land, or marry a citizen, until the time of Augustus in the Roman case. The promotion of Christianity to the state religion gradually changed this situation, and increasingly the distinction was between Christian and non-Christian, the latter further subdivided into adherents of a licit religion, Jews, who were, in theory at least, protected, or of an illicit religion, pagans, who faced severe constraints. The same model took hold in the Arab Empire, with non-Muslims being classified either as possessors of a scripture, Ahl al-Kitab, in which case they could pay a tax in return for protection and the right to continue in their religion, or as pagans, Mushrikun, who faced the stark choice of conversion or death. The Sasanian-Persian Empire, by contrast, tended to put more weight on social distinctions, having a caste-like system, than on religious distinctions. The Georgian patriarch emphasized to his Armenian counterpart that Khusro II, unlike the Byzantines, permitted every people to have its own religion, and certainly a number of groups that would have looked decidedly pagan to the Byzantine Christians, such as the Mandeans and Yazidis of Iraq, enjoyed protection. Fortunately, the Muslim government in Iraq left in place this tradition, categorizing most as possessors of a scripture, and as a result, such groups have survived until modern times, although in drastically reduced numbers. Medieval and modern historians tend to assume that the Arabs enforced the distinction between Muslim and non-Muslim as soon as they began their conquests. However, as we have seen, there were many non-Muslims in their ranks initially. What united them was their focus on jihad, and so the distinction in the early decades was chiefly between conquerors and conquered. Only later, when most of the non-Muslims in the imperial armies had converted to Islam, did the division conqueror-conquered shift to Muslim-non-Muslim. In any case, it is only with Umar II that we begin to have contemporary evidence for discriminatory policies. The stimulus for this seems to have been the ignominious failure of the Arab siege of Constantinople in 717 to 718 and the huge loss of Arab life. This defeat intensified hostility toward Byzantium and by association toward Christians, and it also accelerated the professionalization of the army. Many Arab Muslims relinquished their military role and became civilians, but they did not want to rub shoulders on an equal footing with the non-Muslim conquered peoples. Accordingly, restrictions were placed on the latter to keep them in their subject position. The raw material for these restrictions came mostly from Byzantine curbs on Jews, not building new synagogues, not giving testimony against Christians, not defaming Christianity, etc., and Sasanian-Persian regulations for distinguishing between nobles and commoners, not wearing the same headgear, overcoats, belts, shoes, and hairstyles of the superior group, etc. Gradually, there evolved an extensive body of legal rulings governing what non-Muslims could and could not do, and how they should behave toward Muslims. Jews and Christians and other non-Muslims became a subordinate class, and yet were integrated within the Muslim legal system and granted protection. Differential taxation. The most contentious aspect of this discriminatory policy was taxation. Initially, as one would expect, the Arabs, as conquerors and soldiers' rulers, did not pay any taxes. The adult male conquered people, on the other hand, all paid tax, irrespective of their religion or ethnicity, unless they were granted an exemption in return for providing military service or spying or the like. Contemporary Egyptian papyri make clear that there were a number of different taxes, but the main two were land tax and poll tax. The latter came to be regarded as a religious tax, payable only by non-Muslims, but in the beginning it was simply what the conquered people paid to the conquerors, though it may have been perceived as apt that those whom God had evidently forsaken should pay for the upkeep of those whom God had patently favored. The Arab conquerors would probably have wished that things stayed that way, themselves living a life of luxury at the expense of the conquered. Inevitably, however, many of the latter sought to get a share of the immense privileges enjoyed by the conquerors, in particular, release from taxes. Fiscal agents for Hajjaj complained again and again that the tax revenue has diminished, for the conquered people have become Muslims and gone off to the garrison cities. One group that we hear a lot about in the papyri of the late 7th and early 8th centuries are peasants who had fallen behind with their taxes and left their land in the hope of escaping their plight by conversion. In former times, they would have sought refuge in a monastery, whereas now they hoped to find service with an Arab patron or to be enrolled in the army. This situation also left its mark in the Muslim literary sources, which recount numerous tales of ragtag groups of converts who served alongside registered soldiers in the army, but received no pay or rations. The authorities did not want such untrained recruits in the military, and worried about the depletion of the agricultural labor force, and so they usually had them rounded up and sent back to their villages, where they would once again be liable for taxes. Umar II, revered as the most pious and devout of all the Umayyad rulers, sought to extend Abd al-Malik's policy of promoting the status of Islam as the foundation of the Arab Empire. He was, therefore, angry at this treatment of converts to Islam, and he wrote to his governors, ordering them to desist from exacting taxes from Muslims, whatever their origin. He reinforced this point in an edict on taxation. Whosoever accepts Islam, whether Christian, Jew, or Zoroastrian, of those now subject to taxes, and who joins himself to the body of the Muslims in their abode, forsaking the abode in which he was before, he shall have the same rights and duties as they have, and they are obliged to associate with him and to treat him as one of themselves. His successors, however, obstructed this policy, and some governors circumvented it by agreeing to relieve recent converts of taxes, but only on condition that they could demonstrate the sincerity of their conversion by reciting a portion of the Quran and undergoing circumcision, which provoked widespread retraction. The problem might usefully be compared to the attitude of modern wealthy nations toward immigration. Being a citizen of such countries brings many benefits, and those who are already citizens tend to be nervous that if the door is opened wide to immigrants, those benefits will be diluted. The authorities would ideally like to accept only educated and skilled immigrants, but it can be difficult to justify a selection process on legal grounds, and returning failed immigrants is always contentious. The conquerors were in much the same position. The benefits that they enjoyed were very generous, and so there really was no way that these could be extended to all who sought to join them without decimating the economy. The choice before them was either to use increasing force to stem the tide of would-be members of their club, or to reduce the benefit package. Not surprisingly, given their numerical inferiority, the Arabs chose the latter course, and from the time of Abd al-Malik onward, a number of major changes were introduced with the aim of making the financial basis of the Arab Empire more sustainable. First, as we have said before, the incentive to enroll in the army was reduced by commuting payments to soldiers as a reward for past participation into a regular salary for continuing service. One could no longer rest on former glory, but had to remain an active and full-time soldier. This not only made would-be recruits pause for thought before signing up, but also prompted a number of existing members to opt out and join the civilian ranks. Second, to stem the reduction in land tax caused by non-Muslim farmers converting to Islam and Muslims buying land from non-Muslims, there was a shift from payment according to category of person, Muslim or non-Muslims, to payment according to category of land. In general, for non-crown lands, there was now a uniform land tax levied on Muslims and non-Muslims alike. The third reform was to provide a Muslim counterpart to the poll tax, which had come to be seen as a specifically non-Muslim tax. The solution was to make almsgiving for Muslims compulsory, collected just like a tax. This policy was probably introduced not long before 730, when we find Najd ibn Muslim, the governor of the Fayyum district, south of modern Cairo, both justifying and explaining the new system to an underling. God sent his prophet Muhammad, may God praise him, with guidance and the true religion and everything that God approves of for his worshippers. On those belonging to the people of the religion of Islam, Ahl al-Islam, the upright religion, God has imposed an alms tax, sadaqah, on their property in order to purify them. Give a receipt for everything that you have taken from each person with their name, the name of their father, their tribe, and village. By the second half of the 8th century, the island of privilege that the early Arab conquest society had been no longer existed. An average Muslim very likely paid less tax than an average non-Muslim, but it varied according to profession and status, and of course, the reality of tax collection was very much more complex than the simple and elegant theories of the lawyers. Muslim revolts and the fall of the Umayyads. Though they may have been necessary, these reforms to the tax system stoked resentment against the Umayyads, and together with the run of defeats experienced by the imperial armies in the 730s, added to the sentiment that the Umayyads were unjust and ungodly rulers. The Iraqi participants in Ibn al-Ash'ath's revolt in 701 first demonstrated their animosity by burning the tax registers, a sure sign of the object of their fury. Many different groups felt that they had lost out, in particular, local elites and recent converts to Islam. The former had been acting as tax collectors for the Arabs. The taxes on many cities and regions were assessed as a lump sum, and these local notables were entrusted with the task of apportioning it among the local inhabitants, a job that gave them autonomy, status, and the means to work the system as best suited them. As a part of the reforms, however, there was a gradual shift from collective to individual assessment, with the actual collection carried out more and more by agents directly appointed by the state, diminishing the role of the local nobility. Recent and would-be converts to Islam, especially low-status individuals, often encountered hostility from the authorities and were frequently denied the exemption from poll tax that they had been promised when they converted. This situation worsened as the number of converts increased, which happened in the aftermath of the failed siege of Constantinople, when military campaigns were often supplemented by missionary activities, presumably in the belief that converts would be more loyal to the regime. For example, Umar II dispatched a group of Muslim religious scholars to Africa and Mauritania to disseminate Islam there in 718. Over in the east, Ashras ibn Abdullah, the governor of Khorasan, 727 to 730, advertised for a man possessing piety and virtue, whom I may send across the Oxus to call people there to Islam. The man they hired preached in the environs of Samarkand, declaring that those who became Muslim would be freed of the poll tax, and the people flocked to him. New mosques were built, and instructors taught the neophytes how to pray and recited Quranic verses with them in Persian. However, when Ashras realized that a consequence of his policy was a sharp drop in tax revenues, he ordered, "Take the tax from whomever you used to take it from." And so they reimposed the poll tax on those who had become Muslim, prompting many to apostatize. These and other grievances drove many into the arms of various opposition movements. There were two broad umbrella groups, which came in many local varieties, but represented two very different attitudes toward government. At one end of the spectrum were the Qarajites, who argued that the office of caliph should go to the most qualified and suitable person, irrespective of his ethnicity or ancestry, and that the caliph should be a first among equals rather than an absolute ruler. Charisma and authority rested, they felt, principally with the community, which had a direct relationship with God and did not need a power broker to act on their behalf. At the other end of the spectrum were the Shiites. Instead of a charismatic community served by the leader, they supported the notion of a charismatic leader served by the community. Ali, by virtue of his marriage to the daughter of Muhammad, had inherited the prophet's religious charisma, and it continued to flow through his descendants, whom Shiites therefore strove to place at the helm of the Islamic world. Both views of the leadership contrasted with the position of the Umayyads, who stressed that the right to determine political and religious matters had passed from prophets to caliphs, and that they were the clan best suited to discharge this office. Protagonists of these two anti-government movements had already been flexing their muscle during the Second Arab Civil War, but by the 1730s they had become more numerous, largely by winning over many non-Arabs to their cause, and more ambitious. This is apparent in the numismatic record, for many of them were minting their own coins across surprisingly large areas. In Northwest Africa, as we have seen, there was a rash of Karajite uprisings, some of which led to the installation of local rulers at places like Tripoli and Tlemcen in modern West Algeria. In Yemen, one rebel had himself proclaimed caliph in 746, taking the regnal title Seeker of Truth, Talib al-Haq, and went so far as to seize control of Mecca and Medina, though this prompted a swift response from the Umayyad authorities, who assassinated the pretender in 748. Karajite revolutionaries were endemic in the countryside of the Jazeera, but the disorder of the 740s allowed them to expand their operations, and coins struck at Mosul and Kufa by a local Karajite leader and scholar show that they had managed to extend their authority to cities. Shiite rebels did particularly well in the former Persian lands, at least in part because the idea of a leader belonging to a sacred lineage and endowed with divine charisma gelled well with ancient Iranian ideas of kingship. Also, Shiism's belief that the gates of prophecy and divine inspiration were still open made it more receptive than other Islamic sects to tenets of the Persian religious tradition, such as messianism, dualism, cyclical time, and indwelling of the divine spirit. A good example is provided by the movement of the freedman Mughira ibn Sa'id, who supported the imamate of Muhammad al-Bakr, died 743, a great-grandson of Ali, and portrayed him as a savior figure. Mughira preached that God was a man of light, with a crown of light on his head, and that his limbs corresponded to the letters of the Arabic alphabet, and he taught an elaborate creation myth which rested on a strong contrast between light and dark. God wrote with his finger on his palm men's deeds of obedience and disobedience. The latter angered him, and he sweated, and two seas were formed from his sweat, one salt and dark, and one sweet and bright. He gazed into the sea and saw his shadow. He went forth to seize it, but it flew away. He then plucked out the eye of his shadow and from it created a sun. He annihilated the shadow and said, "There should not be another God besides me." He then made all creation from the two seas. He called forth the unbelievers from the salt, dark sea, and the believers from the sweet, bright sea. And he fashioned the shadows of men. The first shadows he created were those of Muhammad and Ali. Shortly after Muhammad al-Bakr died, Abdullah ibn Muawiyah, a grandson of Ali's brother Ja'far, rebelled in Kufa in October 744. He traveled from Iraq to Iran and traversed that land in search of support for his claim to the caliphate on the basis of his kinship with Ali and Muhammad, a message he substantiated by stamping on his coinage the Quranic verse, "I ask of you no recompense except love of kin," which was understood by Shiites as an exhortation by Muhammad to honor his daughter Fatima, her husband Ali, and their descendants. Among Abdullah's most fervent followers were a loose-knit band known as the Janahiyya, who maintained that the Spirit of God had first dwelt in Adam and then passed to the prophets and imams, including Ali, his son Muhammad, his son Abdullah Abu Hashim, and then from him to Abdullah ibn Muawiyah. Of course, the latter may have been suspicious, if not downright dismissive, of such elements within the ranks of his supporters, and in general the more staid wing of the Shiites were wary of those among them whom they saw as extremists, ghulat. But nevertheless, Shiism did come to adopt a number of these Persian-influenced beliefs, especially the notion that their imams were divinely inspired. Although very popular, these two religio-political movements by no means encapsulated the full range of opposition to the Umayyads, and some uprisings had very local coloring. In the region around Balkh, in modern North Afghanistan, a rebel named Harith ibn Suraj managed to defy the authorities for 12 years, 734 to 746, and won to his side a stunningly diverse array of supporters, including the Khagan of the Turgesh. Muslim sources say that he adhered to the doctrine of the Murjaites, who professed that faith alone was sufficient to be a Muslim, without any necessity for virtuous behavior. This was directed against the Karajites, who said that good deeds were an integral part of being a Muslim, and that evil deeds could exclude one from the Muslim community. But it attracted support from those converts who had been told that their conversion was not valid unless accompanied by actions such as memorization of the Quran and circumcision. This region of East Iran, Transoxania, provided a majority of the troops who would overthrow the Umayyad dynasty in AD 750, and also many of the scholars who would play a leading role in creating a new Islamic civilization, breaking it away from the more narrow Judeo-Christian focus that it had had in Damascus and suffusing it with elements from this culturally syncretic world. There were a number of reasons why this region was so pivotal. First, its terrain is difficult for conquerors, and by the time they had got this far east, the Arabs were overstretched. So, whereas in West Iran they had crushed the local elites, here they worked with them, which meant that the region's culture was to some extent preserved. Second, many of the religions it harbored, Christianity, Buddhism, Manichaeism, placed a high value on literacy, and this was further strengthened by the strong mercantile credentials of the region as a major junction of trade routes between China, India, and the Mediterranean world. Third, the Arabs were commonly settled in cities among the population, at Merv, Balkh, after 726, Bukhara, and Samarkand, for example, rather than in separate garrisons as happened in Iraq and Egypt. This, plus the missionary efforts initiated by some local governors, meant that there was much interaction and assimilation between the conquerors and conquered, and since the Arabs were relatively few and far from home, they, or at least their descendants, took Persian wives, began to speak Persian, and attended Persian festivals like Nowruz. Ethnic and cultural allegiances became blurred, and a Persianized Islam became the common idiom for a new elite. Tellingly, when the governor Nasser ibn Sayyar and the rebel Harith ibn Suraj decided to negotiate, they chose to represent them, men mindful of the Book of God, namely Muqattil ibn Hayyan, a lawyer resident in Balkh, and Jahim ibn Safwan, a theologian resident in Tirmid, both sons of Persian captives turned Muslim. And the architect of the Abbasid Revolution, Abu Muslim, who was also a native of this region, when asked who he was, replied, "I am a man from among the Muslims, and I do not trace my descent to any one group to the exclusion of another. My only ancestry is Islam." People like Muqattil ibn Hayyan, Jahim ibn Safwan, and Abu Muslim are a good example of how quickly many of the conquered people became involved in the religious, cultural, and political life of the world of the conquerors. In the introduction to this book, I pointed out how much Western scholars fixated on the speed of the Arab conquests, but what is much more remarkable is the rapid rate at which a new empire emerged from the ashes of the old. If one examines the family histories of some of the main actors of this new regime, both Arab and non-Arab, one can see that in only three generations, their whole social situation and cultural orientation has changed beyond recognition. To some degree, that is the exciting thing about all empires, and in any imperial capital in history, one can find characters who have gone from rags to riches, from obscurity to fame, or from servitude to high office in a single lifetime. But this seems to have happened on a particularly grand scale and at an accelerated rate in the case of the Arab Empire, and it is to this question of the rapid incubation of Islamic civilization that we shall now turn. Chapter 7. The Making of Islamic Civilization. A century or so of fighting and campaigning had seen Arab armies achieve victories from the Atlantic Ocean to the Aral Sea, from the Atlas Mountains to the Hindu Kush. Now, however, they had come up against a combination of natural barriers and well-organized states that impeded further progress. Islam would still spread further, but local dynasties, missionaries, and traders would henceforth act as its standard-bearers, not Arab armies. This meant that the easy supply of booty dried up, prompting many more fighters to exchange their military gear for civilian garb. The focus on jihad and acquiring territory gave way to building an Islamic empire and forging an Islamic civilization. The conquests had provided the space for Islam to flourish, but had not allowed the time for it to develop. Islamic law, science, philosophy, theology,